Support for this podcast comes from Facebook. Running a business is challenging in 2020. That's why many small business owners are turning to Facebook tools. Owners like Stasha Harris, founder of the Brooklyn hair studio Magic Fingers. When she couldn't meet clients in person, she held braiding tutorials over Instagram Live for thousands of her followers. Stasha kept going, even when the rest of the world stopped. Connect to the customers you're looking for with Facebook tools. Visit facebook.com/smallbusiness.
Welcome to The John Roa Show, a production of iHeartRadio and Roa Media Works. This is Leading From Home, a special limited series where I'm checking in with leaders and entrepreneurs from across the country on how they're dealing with the coronavirus pandemic. It's Monday, May 11th. It's now been 61 days since the pandemic began. The music industry has come to a grinding halt. First, it was bands like Pearl Jam and Rage Against the Machine had to postpone big tours. And then Coachella, Stagecoach, and South By, and the list goes on of other festivals that have been delayed. And now, it seems like every day, there's another casualty in the music realm, all in the name of keeping fans safe. Even the Smashing Pumpkins, one of the most influential bands in history, were forced to reschedule their Rock Invasion 2 tour until the fall because of the outbreak. Now the fate of the band's tour that was supposed to be this summer with Guns N' Roses and the release of their new double album remains up in the air. But one question looms large over the entire live entertainment industry. What will concerts look like after the pandemic? And will fans feel comfortable attending even when they're allowed to? Some health experts and government officials predict that concerts and festivals can't be held safely until next year. And now that would be a crushing blow to the music industry when a lot of artists' income comes solely from touring. With all of this uncertainty, I wanted to turn to somebody who's been through everything in the industry and get some clarity on what might come next. Today, my close friend, drummer Jimmy Chamberlain from the Smashing Pumpkins, joins the podcast to discuss how the coronavirus has affected the industry, how it compares to other shakeups over the decades, and what might happen next.
So how's it going out there?
It's good. It's okay.
You know, you're in New York, right?
Still in Manhattan, man. Haven't left. I literally haven't left the city limits once.
Wow.
You know, and it's funny because that's the reaction. That's the appropriate reaction, right? Like New York is a shit show and for good reason and the numbers and everything else. But, you know, if I was ill, this is probably the worst place to be. But if you're, yeah, you know, in my situation, everybody is either gone or inside, so it's incredibly quiet. There's no traffic. There's no horns. There's no tourists.
Right.
The markets are all well-stocked and empty. Like, I walk in, and I'm the only person in there, and I buy, you know, cleaning supplies and toilet paper and food. And, like, so I haven't had the experience that, like, my siblings have, where they're waiting in line at Trader Joe's for 2 hours to, you know, buy an avocado or something. So to me, it's actually been quite pleasant, if not, you know, incredibly boring and weirdly isolating, you know.
I'm always in a kind of quasi state of quarantine anyway, just self-imposed.
So for sure.
So for me, it's not that big of a stretch. My daughter, who's in the IB program, she hasn't missed a beat. I mean, she's really, like, her school was way on top of it. They moved everything to Zoom, and really they haven't really. I felt like they haven't really missed anything. My son's school, the middle school, has been a little bit slow on the uptake, but they're getting it together. And now we're just wondering if school doesn't get into session next year or this, you know, next summer.
Yeah.
You know, do we have maybe some other choices for him? Like, you know, if he's going to go to school online, I mean, it starts to be like, well, I don't need an office and I don't need a sale. I can have guys in Dubai. I can have guys in, right, you know, wherever I want for my company, if it's always going to be remotely. Like, it's the same with schools. Like, could he go to Andover Prep? Could he go, know, where could he go?
I mean, it's crazy, man. Like, you know, my sister and two of my best friends are teachers. Well, one's a principal of a private school in LA, and the other two are teachers. And like hearing them adjusting in real time and trying to make sense of all of this and dealing with all the crazy parents and the new curriculums and these requirements and the chaos, it's just got to be brutal. I feel, you know, I feel a lot for those folks in the schooling system right now.
It's not what they studied to be, right? It's not what they trained to be. It wouldn't be unlike, you know, if you were like a carpenter and all of a sudden you got to work and they were like, okay, today you're going to run the crane. what do you mean? Like, well, you know, things have changed. Like, you got to figure this out. And, you know, I think it's a lot of them, especially the older teachers, it's just an alien landscape, right?
For sure. 100%. It's a lot. And I don't think anybody has it particularly easy right now. But you do feel for teachers and for a lot of the essential workers, and it's crazy. And it's, you know, I think we throw around the word unprecedented a lot. But I think this is an appropriate time to use it because, you know, for sure not in our lifetimes and probably not for generations before has every single person in the world felt the same thing at the same time. I mean, that is just a brand new phenomenon. 7.5 billion people all feeling the exact same anxieties at the same time and uncertainties.
No, it is. There's the collective, you know, emotional gravity of this is pretty compelling. I mean, for me as an artist, like, it's really been hard because you're dealing with kind of, you know, the interpretation of succinct frequencies, right? And that's kind of where the creative process kind of starts and ends. But I've never experienced anything this wide, right? Yeah. Where there's so many variables within the conduit of emotion, and there's so much weight to the collective. It's like, it just becomes really hard to interpret it or channel it out. So I find myself like playing my instrument way less. And when I do, it's this kind of outpouring of, you know, a million different tangents, you know, whereas before when, you know, everything was kind of homogenized, I mean, you had your lane and you went in and you knew how to kind of create within this box, but now the box has just been completely obliterated.
Right.
You know, and there is no box. I mean, the box is kind of because it went from being like, you know, Chicago to being like the universe.
Yeah.
Like, okay, well, it's going to take a while for me to clean this cabinet out and then to figure out like what in here is actually musical and then, you know, start to channel it into something that's, you know, interpretive.
100%. That fascinates me because I've talked to a lot of people now, you know, on the podcast and elsewhere. And, you know, you can't blame anybody for where they're going, but you're seeing this incredible spectrum of behavior. You know, there's people who are learning two new languages and new hobbies and are like at peak performance. There's others who can't get out of bed. And again, all of it is perfectly acceptable. But when it comes to the creative arts, you know, this has been fascinating to me because of just, I feel stifled, and I'm not a creative. I'm pretending to be a writer and stuff, but like that is not my discipline, right? I'm much more of a business person. So somebody who's inherently creative and lives on those creative juices and energy, this has just got to be an absolutely brutal time. But I also imagine that it's going to be a source of a lot of inspiration for creatives to come, right?
Well, I think so. Yeah, I think that's the hope, right? And I think once, you know, we start to get, or I start to get, or the creatives, so to speak, start to get a beat on where the destination may lie, then I think it becomes easier to build a road to those things, right? And that's really, like, for me, like, the creative process is really about building a road or a path or some type of conduit to another place, you know, via kind of emoting through my instrument. The more the destination becomes nebulous, the harder it becomes to even, it's like walking out your door with a blindfold on for the, you know, having never walked through your door before and then hoping to get somewhere that's useful, like a store.
Right.
Just like,
for sure.
I mean, it becomes that vague, at least for me. I know, you know, and I know a lot of people that are doing what, you know, you said, they're making good use of their time and they're practicing and, you know, those types of things where, you know, there's a lot of kind of busy work that can be caught up on.
Yeah.
But the big picture, as far as like I'm good with the what and kind of how of music, right? I mean, like, if I know how to practice, I know what to do. I know how to make myself a better facilitator and a better technician. But without the why, it becomes very kind of, you know, amorphous and like, you know, what's the point, right? I mean, there's only one reason to play music, and that's, you know, it's the goal of self-expression, right? And technique and those types of things enable us to paint with more vivid colors. But if we don't know why we're doing it, then it becomes, you know, almost offensive, right, in a way, exactly, where you're like, you know, I'm kind of offending myself by not knowing why I'm doing this, right? Like, it's like, you know, raising cattle, but you don't eat beef, right? I don't know what the metaphor is, but it's, you know, there's a few of them out there where, like, you know, I love to catch fish, but I don't like to eat them, you know, like those types of things. So, you know, it gets to be kind of, things become diametrically opposed that were never opposed.
That's right. Yeah. I talked to Keon Harold this week on the podcast, who's obviously, you know, a big trumpeter. And he was talking about the jazz world, which has been hit hard through the pandemic.
Oh, yeah.
And we've lost some greats in the last couple of months. And it's, you know, in these different pockets of music. For him, it's jazz. And for you, obviously, it's jazz as well, being, you know, an incredibly talented jazz drummer. But you're also spanning the rock world and others. So in each of these communities, how has this pandemic affected those specifically?
Well, you know, to your point, the jazz community has just been upended, right? And you know, all of my friends that live in New York, and there's hundreds of them that make their living playing music on a nightly basis. And some of them are well into their 70s, and some of them that I know are into their 90s. And still, you know, Roy Haynes is 94, 95, still plays, you know, five nights a week, and that's how he makes his living, you know, to a large part. You know, I mean, I don't know what anybody's financial situation really is, but I know these people work, you know, they love to work and it's their livelihood. You know, in that respect, you know, what do you do? Like, even my friend Carter McLean, who's the drummer for The Lion King, you know, he's been home for 45 days.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's what I'm talking about. Like, when you, like, my purpose as a musician, my sense of purpose is to communicate, right? And using self-expression as a mechanism to communicate, when that's no longer available to you, you go into this kind of state of mourning almost, because, you know, you have, you know, this beautiful car in the garage and there's nowhere to drive it, right? And it gets to be, at least for me, it gets to be, again, like, where I find myself, like, I want to walk downstairs to my studio and I want to play some music, but I don't really know why. And I mean, that goes beyond the kind of obvious economic ramifications of this, like, how do I eat? You know, a lot of my friends have used this opportunity to do, you know, online classes and make themselves available to do like Patreon stuff. And that's been great. It's great that there's those digital tools out there for people to continue to generate revenue. But I think on the larger scale, like, why do we play music in the first place? When those questions, you know, cease to be able to be answered, then we've got them, to your point, we're in a different world altogether.
Yeah. You know, you've been through a number of different times of your life and career, you know, obviously with been playing music now for decades and with the Pumpkins being one of the biggest bands in the 90s. And then since then have gone through different bands with Back of the Pumpkins. You've come in and out of music, you know, in terms of that being your 100% focus. And we met when you had crossed paths over to the business world and the tech startup world, which you're still involved in different ways. And so you've had to be a musician and a business person through a lot of different adversity. I mean, when the world has changed, when the music industry, you know, came and went, when digital kicked in and changed all the labels, when you've had different, you know, world paradigm shifts like 9/11. So all of these different, you know, waves. So with all of that perspective, which is an incredibly unique perspective, what might come after this? Like, do you have predictions, or can you kind of look back on trends and guess as to what might come off the back of this and with your focus and disciplines?
I mean, I have a couple of theories, but again, I mean, this is so anomalous and so, you know, to your point, so widespread and so gravitationally huge that it's hard to say where it all comes out to. And you're right. Like, I was a musician making a living on, you know, recorded music when Napster hit, and we weathered that storm. And, you know, the one thing I'll say about, you know, people like myself, people like you, who I know you know, are doing things for very specific reasons. The impetus to create, I think, is always there, right? And I think when you remove the kind of glitter from it, you know, it does tend to separate the wheat from the chaff, so to speak, in the artist community, because a lot of people, it's like tech, right? A lot of people go into the tech space with stars in their eyes. They're going to be the next Twitter. They're going to be the next TikTok. And as you know, 99% of them, it doesn't manifest, right? And it's the same in the music industry. A lot of them want to stand on stage at Madison Square Garden, but when they realize that it's probably going to require them eating out of, you know, eating cans of beefaroni in somebody else's apartment for, you know, 2 or 3 years, then it stops to be glamorous and other things start to make more sense, right? So I think anytime there's this kind of, you know, cataclysmic adversity, it strengthens the herd, so to speak, in a lot of ways that may not be obvious right now. But I think anytime, you know, humanity is tasked with this type of endeavor, it always comes out as a stronger organism, right? Spiritually, physically, maybe compassionately would be my hope.
Yeah.
That, you know, things get rooted in less individualism and less exceptionalism and more kind of humanistic, compassionate viewpoints on people's situations and, you know, people's common experiences. Those are the reasons that these things happen, right? Those, anytime, you know, there's a foreign body in your body or mind, there's a reason. It's always a strengthening mechanism. And sometimes it obviously kills us or tears us down. But generally, over time, you know, the pack gets stronger. So, you know, my hope would be that, you know, people start to see the value in the thing that is the most valuable to them, which is how they spend their time.
Yeah, that's right. You mentioned Madison Square Garden. I know you guys had a major tour. What's up with that for this year?
Well, this year was kind of a down year for us anyway. We felt like, you know, we had done 2 full years of touring. We did the big Shiny and Oh So Bright tour in 2018. And then last year we did 2 months in Europe. And then we did a Shed tour with Noel Gallagher, which was amazing. This year was really, we were just going to take a year off and record some music, which we've done. We've got a 20-song album done, mixed, produced, ready to go. We're working on another album right now. Billy and I are working on some songs, just file sharing back and forth. So this year wasn't a big touring cycle for us. But for a lot of my friends, I mean, Rage Against the Machine, I mean, there was a lot of bands that were just getting ready to go out and, you know, start a big cycle. And I think for them, it's just been crushing. I mean, it's and for anybody. I mean, my brother-in-law owns 3 restaurants in California.
Yep.
You know, his business just disappeared. I mean, so, you know, it's like, to your point, I mean, everybody is really in some part of the same boat these days.
100%.
No matter how much, you know, even if you got, you know, even if you're well off, you have a lot of money. I mean, I have a lot of rich friends. You have a lot of rich friends. It's like, they're feeling the same thing, man. There's stuff like, okay, you got a lot of money. Where are you going to go spend it? I mean, right?
Yeah. I had that exact discussion with somebody, you know, because the implication is, and listen, I'm sure that you know, financial strain just takes a horrible situation and compounds it. Like I'm not diminishing that in the least. And that is probably one of the prime stressors, but that's not the same thing as if you don't have financial strain, as if nothing is wrong. Right. And so there's unilateral, you know, challenges, stressors, issues, and anxieties with every single person right now. And I think that the empathy to that across the board, and then finding ways to help out your neighbor and your friends and your family is paramount in these situations.
No, that's it. I mean, I know plenty of people who live on fixed incomes, who sold companies, you know, 10, 20 years ago, who took a 30% hit in this market. I mean, you know, with interest rates going to zero or near zero and treasuries being, you know, basically, you know, non-existent right now. I mean, there's no vehicles to preserve wealth right now that you can kind of count on. you know, so it's been a struggle across the board. And as you know, I mean, I've been dirt poor. I've had money. It's like, some things change, but not much. I mean, my relationship with my kids, you know, it's never been predicated on like, you know, what we can buy or what. It's always just been predicated on how we spend our time, right?
Yeah.
One of the coolest things that somebody ever said to me was, shortly before I met you, and I left the Pumpkins in 09 and kind of was trying to figure it out. It was just, you know, it was a matter of me and the band just not being in alignment at the time. I had two kids. Nobody else in the band had kids. I didn't want to spend all my time on the road or doing those types of arty projects. I wanted to spend time with my family. You know, when I was looking for stuff in the tech space, or when I was thinking about leaving the Pumpkins, I talked to my good friend, this guy, Dr. Paul Lederer, who was he was a former president of the Art Institute. I met him because he was a vision specialist, and one of my oldest had dysgraphia, so he was working with Audrey on her handwriting, and him and I got to be pretty good friends. And then, you know, and he became a bit of a mentor to me. So when I was leaving the band, I leaned on him a bit and I was like, look, you know, I'm leaving all this money on the table. I mean, should I try to just suck it up and get it done or blah, blah, blah. And I got kids to raise and this and that, and just all this belly aching about money and right. What am I going to do? And this is like before I even thought about entering the tech space. But he said, look, Jimmy, and Paul's parents were Holocaust survivors, right? So he said, look, I'm going to tell you something about kids. He goes, I remember sitting on the couch with my dad. He goes, I couldn't tell you what that couch looked like right now. He goes, and I remember taking long rides with my parents. He's like, I don't remember what car we were driving. He's like, I just remember the time.
Right.
Your kids, your friends, your family, they're going to remember the time. They're going to remember the picnic and the conversation versus, you know, how cool your landscaping was or how cool your house was.
Exactly,
right.
Yeah.
So I've always, you know, from that point on, I've always been about like, look, my time is my most valuable thing, and it's going to take a lot to get me to mortgage it. Right. So if I use that as my kind of, you know, Northern Star, then I'm always in a good place, no matter what I'm negotiating to.
That's right. And this is where you and I became friends and bonded years ago, because, you know, I was in the midst of chaos running this tech company that I never felt, you know, like I was, you know, fully in control or capable of what I was doing, despite, you know, the success that we had. And we'd sit down, we had these great breakfasts, and every single time, the perspective that you were able to offer into real life and what matters and priorities and importance were the things that, frankly, I feel got me through those years. And you have just such that interesting viewpoint on the world because of what you've experienced, and also your ability and willingness to jump into new opportunities. And so on that vein, you know, you went from being in one of the biggest bands ever to jumping into the tech world. And that's a transition you don't hear about a ton. And I want to hear a bit about the perspective that you can offer from those transitions, kind of what you learned, and especially for people that might be thinking right now. I mean, obviously it won't be that transition, but there's going to be a lot of transition after this. And people might be saying, like, what I'm doing now isn't working anymore. I might need to switch gears in my life or my career or whatever. What insight can you provide to somebody who's looking to make a big change in their life after all this chaos dies down?
Well, you know, a couple things. So, you know, jumped into the tech space is kind of, you know, that's a nice way to say, you know, but I honestly felt like I was kind of pushed into the tech space by, you know, Kevin Willer and those guys.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I had met a few guys and, you know, don't forget, that's when Groupon was starting to take off in Chicago, right? So I knew, you know, I knew Lefkowski and I knew Andrew Mason. And I knew Jason Child, who was the CFO over there. And those guys were the ones that were really, they knew I was out of the band. They were trying to rope me into doing something with Groupon. And, you know, I had known Mason. You know, Mason was the intern at Electrical Audio when Corgan and I were recording the Zwan record in like 2002. So last time I'd seen Andrew Mason, he was the guy who like got my coffee and sandwich order wrong. Right at the studio, and I'm like, and then the next time I saw him, he was the CEO of Groupon and just like cashed like a $700 million chip, right? And I was, and he was like, and you know, one of the things he said to me, he goes, oh, Jimmy, you were always so nice to me. And I was thinking in the back of my head, man, always, you never know, right? In this crazy world, you just never know.
That's,
man,
right.
Just,
yeah.
It doesn't matter. I've seen people go from like the janitor to president of the record company. Just be nice to everybody, right?
Right?
Just treat everybody.
Man, that's hilarious.
Treat everybody the way you want to be treated. you know, but through that, through, and Mason, you know, was on me to start, come in and start a record company with Groupon's database. And I'm like, I don't want to play for the other team. I don't want to be in a record company. I don't want to do that. I like the tech space. And, you know, through those relationships, I met Stuart Larkins from Chicago Ventures, which was I2A at the time, Kevin Willer, Jim Strybeck, Jim O'Connor, like all the guys that were the major players in the tech space. And it was just a bunch of kind of sitting around and spitballing, and them, you know, them asking me questions about the music industry. And it was, I think, Stuart that came up to me and said, look, you know, you've got such an interesting perspective and such a bead on the tech space that no one else has. He goes, why don't you just rack your brain and come up with something and we'll fund it, right? And you can go and dip your toe in this water because we think you'd be really good at it. And it was around that time that, you know, I2A started taking off, and I got a call from Stuart one morning. I was actually driving my kids to school. He's like, hey, can you come down to 1871 and look at this, look at this company? I think we're thinking about investing. These guys are super smart. They've got technology. They're making claims that I think only you would know the answer to, which had to do with the efficacy of digital content consumption in the live stream market at the time, right? So I went down, I listened to the company, John and Tim Ganshaw had an incredible technology called Crowdsurfing, which was a social media ecosystem that built a live digital venue next to video content. So it enabled you to get the feel of a live audience during some type of content consumption, right? Whether it be a concert or a sporting event, and then also subsequently allowed you to communicate via text with other thumbnails in the crowd. They were able to run associative advertising on it and had an admin panel on the back that gathered data. And I thought, man, this is crazy because this is technology, but it's something I know a lot about. You know, pushing emotional buttons with content is something that I do for a living, right? It's like, It was right in my wheelhouse. So, you know, I2A made them some crazy offer of like, we'll give you $250 for like 50% of the company. I mean, you know what it was. Back then, right? And so I went to the guys and I said, look, you know, I mean, I like Stuart, and Stuart's a smart guy, but that's not a lot of money for a lot of the company. I said, why don't you just give me a couple of days and let me see if I can put together some guys to make this a little bit easier for you guys, because I really love this product and I really believe in it. And it was literally, I think, like an hour later, I had the $250 raised.
right. Couple phone calls.
Right? And and so I got involved with the company just as an advisor. And I mean, you know me well enough to know that, like, I don't jump in unless I jump in with both feet, which is, you know, why I don't drink anymore, why I'm a vegan. I'm just kind of an all or nothing OCD guy. So, you know, as is my nature, I kind of dove in. I wasn't doing anything. I was just, you know, kind of freaking these guys out that every day I would just show up at the office down there, and they were like, wait, this guy's like a rock musician, and now he's like showing up at 9 o'clock every day with, like, you know, a J.Crew shirt on and really wanting to get into this. And, you know, at that point, you know, the company was starting to build the product. We were looking for a CEO, and, you know, I found a couple candidates through my pipeline and my network that I thought would be great CEOs. And after this whole like 3 month CEO search, John and Tim and one other person that was on the board called me up and they said, you know, we want you to come on board as CEO. And I was like, what are you talking about? And they're like, we just love the way you operate. We just love the way you've thrown yourself into this business. And the things you don't know, you can learn, obviously. You know, at that point I had read, you know, The Innovator's Dilemma and Lean Startup and Hard Thing About Hard Things. Kind of read every tech manual that you could get your hands on. And really, really enjoyed this space, and found a lot of synergy between, you know, building efficacious tech mechanisms and the music business, right? It's kind of the same thing when you distill it right down. But yeah, and that started, you know, as you know, a 4-year journey to a bankruptcy, you know, which is a great tech story, right?
That's the classic right? tech story, you know, and that's, and even with every, you know, with the good ideas and the money and the connections and the efficacy, like, it's a tough game. You know, it's a brutal game that most people don't succeed, that 99.9% don't win it, you know? And so what are some of the biggest takeaways you had from that? Because I feel like that is just, again, one of the most unique perspectives there is.
Once you understand compositionally what needs to happen to push people's buttons, you can use those same metrics to create both things, right? Hit songs are what? They're culturally congruent, right? They're congruent with the culture that they insert themselves into. They're in harmony with their culture. They have alignment. They have verses that explain things, and they have choruses and refrains that celebrate things. I mean, compositionally, there's not a lot of difference. And I think when you can apply those same force multipliers to both to technology, you can really start to get creative and really get a beat on kind of what it all means, right? You know, that was probably the biggest epiphany that I had, was like, man, creation is kind of creation, and it's really, you know, there's all kinds of vehicles, but the mechanisms are largely the same.
Well, that's awesome, Jimmy. This is, all as always, every time we talk, it's so motivational for me, and I've learned a lot from you over the years.
And vice versa.
This summer, are we going to... You've just been such a great friend, and it's always so fun to chat. Are we going to be able to catch you on stage anywhere this summer, you think? Either at Andy's in Chicago or with the Pumpkins or anything?
You know, I don't know. They're saying, you know, is there a second wave of this virus coming along? The social distancing thing doesn't seem to be working very good in Chicago. Our numbers keep going up in spite of people, you know, quarantining themselves. So again, you know, it's tough. I mean, I think America is maybe not anomalous, but uniquely positioned, not in a good way, against a virus like this, just because of the, you know, years and years of you know, health misinformation and the other stuff that's out there. Yep. As far as the health industry and the pharmaceutical industry, you know, people in this country, you know, over the last few years would rather take a pill than change their diet, right? So those are the types of things, you know, the citizenry that you're dealing with, then I think you're going to have a tougher time. But again, I mean, to your earlier point about, you know, does this foment change? You know, hopefully it does. And hopefully, you know, everybody can look at their bodies as a sacred vessel and start to treat them with a little bit more respect. I mean, I know that I abused the hell out of my body. I know you've abused the hell out of yours when we were kids. I mean, you know, and in a lot of ways, I'm lucky to be here. But the way that I can give thanks for getting lucky is to take care of myself, right?
That's right. I obviously couldn't agree more. We've talked a lot about health, and it's, you know, become very important to both of us after we didn't care enough about it at different times in our lives. So it's amazing. So anybody who's listening, if you haven't caught Jimmy either with the Pumpkins or with the jazz band, which, are you still doing Andy's? Or
yeah, we still play Andy's in the Green Mill, and okay. I come to New York from time to time to play the Iridium and you know, those types of places.
Yeah, anybody who hasn't caught, you know, Jimmy in one of his bands is missing out. So hopefully everyone goes and does that, and hopefully you guys can get back on the road or back on the stage as soon as possible. I can't wait to see you.
Yeah, I mean, we've got to have people to play for, you know.
That's right, 100%. I was talking to, again, Keon this week, and he goes, you know, playing live, he's like, it's like sex. You need someone to do it with.
That's
he's
right.
Like, he's like, otherwise you're just masturbating. And it's like, yeah, I get it. And so, you know, we obviously can't wait to get you back out there. And I'm sure everybody else who supports you guys can't. So thanks again for the time, JC. It's always good to talk to you, my friend. And we'll talk to you soon.
You got it, John. Be good.
All right, buddy. Bye. A big thanks to Jimmy for being on the show and discussing the power of music during the crisis. He's one of those guys that every time we talk, I feel like I learned something, and that was a really fun discussion. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe, leave a review, or share with a friend. 100% of the profits from this limited series will be donated to charities that are helping people through the pandemic. If you're currently leading from home, or if you're an entrepreneur who wants to talk through something or get some advice, I want to hear from you. Head over to roa.com/podcast. That's roa.com/podcast for ways to connect with me. Or hit me on social media at John Roa. That's JohnRoa. The John Roa Show is a production of iHeartRadio and Roa Media Works. For more podcasts from us, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite shows. A special thanks to my producers, Jordan Gaspore here at the show, and Tyler Klang over at iHeartRadio. We'll be back with you on Wednesday. In the meantime, stay safe out there.
What's up? I am Machine Gun Kelly, and look, I know Halloween is going to suck this year because there's no trick-or-treating and all that, but I've got a treat. There's a musical podcast that I made with my friends 24K Golden, Ian Dior, and Dana Dentata, and Satan. Well, Satan's not my friend, but Tommy Lee is, and Tommy Lee is playing Satan. But don't just take it from me. Tell him, Satan.
Thanks, dude. It feels great to be playing Satan on this podcast. Listen to Halloween in Hell on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or whatever you get your podcasts on.